Hey guys, are you looking for a sports book that you can trust? Well, look no further than mybookie.ag, where you can get a 50% match on your initial deposit of up to $1,000 when you use promo code DFSArmy. As a bonus, when you use promo code DFSArmy, you also get a free month of DFSArmy VIP and DFSArmy Beat the Bookie membership. That's a $100 combined value. So we'll help you with your daily fantasy sports and we'll help you with your handicapping. Free when you sign up for mybookie.ag using promo code DFSArmy.
Hey guys, people always ask me what exactly we do in DFSArmy. Basically, if you're someone that likes to play daily fantasy sports, you want to be able to pop in close to lock, get a breakdown of a slate, full set of projections, breaking news, and cheat sheets, player picks, and advice directly from pro players, then DFSArmy is the place for you. We function as a team. We help each other out. We have coaching unlike any other service in the industry. And the proof is in the results. Check out our DFSArmy.com wall of wins to see for yourself the massive number of six-figure wins regular DFSArmy average Joes have won in just the past year. If you're tired of redepositing all the time, you already like playing on FanDuel or DraftKings, but you want to take your game to the next level, it's time to sign up for DFSArmy as a VIP member. Use promo code PODCAST to lock in 20% off the normal monthly rate. That's going to wind up at $39.99, the best deal in the industry. Promo code PODCAST, 20% off, DFSArmy.com, the best deal in the industry. We'll see you in the lobby.
In 2015, an elite DFS Army commando unit formed to bring high-level DFS strategy to the masses. Today, hated by DFS sharks and lineup sellers alike, they continue their quest to turn Joe into DFS pro.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your DFS Army Daily Dispatch brought to you by DFSArmy.com. And I am your host today, Boomer's Daddy. And joining me on this special, special Tuesday is the one, the only, the main man, the cash chalk eater himself, Mr. Chapadong. What is up, brother?
Hey, what's going on? Gotta rinse the chalk out of my mouth. Hold on.
Yeah, you might want to go do that for what we're going to be discussing today. So, for those of you that don't know, I am the lead coach for MLB and NBA, and Chop is basically the guy I go to divvy up my bankroll. I'm kidding. He's the guy that when I started actually having to play cash games, I went to. He's got a good mind on bankroll, on bankroll management. And he is one of the few guys that, for the last couple years, I can talk to a lot about baseball. And what I mean by that is, like, he knows the ins and outs just as much as I do. But he knows it from a number side where he can kind of pick out some stuff and we bounce ideas off of each other all the time. And we've worked really well together since starting the MLB product here at the DFS Army. He kind of bounces around to all sports. He's one of our content editors and he kind of just he's a guy I bounce a lot of ideas off of to go along with it at the same time. So that is who Chop is to me. Now, who Chop is to you is he is the guy that you need to listen to when you are just getting started in DFS or you are trying to learn a new sport. Mainly because he knows kind of how to explain better than I probably do different processes and what to look for when just getting started on a cash game level. My strengths are not cash games because my mind does not work in those areas. I can survive. I can have profitable nights, but my strength is obviously tournaments and game theory. So, what we are going to do today, since it is a light NBA schedule, thank God, We are going to be talking about intros to MLB DFS, okay? Basically, strategy questions, what you need to look for, what he looks for, what I look for, how to divvy up a lot of things, and we're going to go through a bunch of different things here in the next 45 minutes or so and allow you to at least get a firm base, because a lot of our members right now in the DFS Army are either playing baseball for the first time or they're playing baseball for the first time with us. Okay. Now, I want to start off by saying this. You do not need to watch baseball. Chop's going to turn over in his chair right now. Okay. Especially coming from my mouth. You do not need to watch baseball in order to profit at DFS MLB. Okay. Now, I say that with this caveat. I believe that if you have the ability to do so and you know what you are looking for and you know how to apply it, you can gain an edge. However, I also believe that if your decisions are going to be made on tilt based on what your eyes see and it affecting your decision making, you should back off. Meaning this. If you're going to watch the Yankees and you have them stacked and you're sweating them and Aaron Judge goes 0 for 4 with 3 strikeouts against a crap pitcher in Yankee Stadium and everybody else is hitting bombs and you're going to make the decision of not playing Aaron Judge the next day because of that, you don't need to watch the game. In fact, you should probably just shut off your computer and your phone until the games are done so you don't get swayed by that the next day. The worst decision I feel you can make in MLB, the worst phrase I hate hearing is, I pay up for the wrong studs at the wrong time, or every time I pay for XYZ, they bomb. You have to take it into context, I believe. MLB is a sport where if you fail 68% of the time, you're considered a Hall of Famer. Maybe 69% of the time. Okay? It is a high variant sport. And the same is true for MLB DFS. You are going to absolutely just crush some nights, and there's some nights like last night where you're just going to absolutely get smoked. The key is what we're going to talk about today. It's the process. It's the consistency. You cannot focus on the results, in my opinion, because the results are going to skew your thinking. Anything you want to add to that, Chop?
No, I'm honestly, without that caveat, I thought hell just froze over with you saying that you don't have to watch the games because you're a big believer in watching the games help you out. So I'm glad you explained that. I mean, I don't watch every game around the league. I watch my Cardinals and whoever they seem to be playing at the time. And if I've got time, I'll West Coast games or whatever, I'll kind of kick those on late at night while I'm watching, you know, my DFS scores, you know, finish off or whatever. So I'll pick up some of that stuff too. But I'm a numbers guy, and I mean, you know, that's just how I've always seen it across really any of the daily sports, where from football to anything, I watch the games I want to watch and, you know, just mostly watch for results, crunch numbers. But I think the numbers tell me an awful lot, and that works, you know, for my method. And a lot of other guys put a lot of different, you know, visuals into things, you know, what they're seeing. Like last year, I remember you tipped me off to Carlos Gonzalez. He'd been cold pretty much all year long. And you said, yeah, but dude, he's really starting to hit the ball hard. He's just not getting lucky. He's hitting line drives again. They're, you know, they're just not finding holes. And that's all I needed to hear you say before I started scrapping his whatever 208, you know, WOBA or whatever the hell he had at the time. I was just like, all right, I'll start. Because I've been waiting for weeks, months for Cargo to get going again. And all I heard from you as a Rockies fan was, I'm watching the games, he's starting to hit the ball. Okay, fine. I'll roster him a time or two. Boom, boom, boom. Couple of home runs. And all I could do was just type in our little private messages. Thanks, Keith.
Yeah, and you know, it's I'm not, you know me, I really, I'm very passionate about what I do. I love, you know, being able to break down baseball. That's my first love and passion. I really like NBA, but if you give me a choice, I would probably scrap NBA for MLB. I love pretty much a 90%, 98% of what the MLB has to offer. But I don't usually toot my own horn a lot when it comes to stuff like that. I let you do it because you know that and you, you're able to do it a lot better than I am. But I've been able to, I know I can take what I'm seeing on the TV. I can go look at some numbers. I can rewatch at bats. I can rewatch pitch sequences, and I can let you know exactly what's going to happen. It might not be that night, but it's going to be pretty close. You know,
yeah, for sure. I'll never do that. That's never, ever going to be part of my process. Rewinding and watching pitch sequences and all that. It's just not how I analyze and watch baseball. I just don't. Which, by the way, we have another staff member at DFS Army, Bowerman Pickles, which is a hitting coach in real life. That's his career.
We've talked he does the a same lot. Thing.
He looks at that stuff and dives in. Like right now, he's working on a piece about Tim Beckham. Which is really loading into a lot of the swing plane analytics and things that is should be coming for, you know, DFS Army VIPs fairly soon. And he's going to be putting together some umpire articles, which gets us way ahead of the curve as far as the rest of the industry is concerned, where everybody's kind of starting to talk a little bit about umpires and strike zones and stuff. But he really goes into how that correlates with daily fantasy sports. Does it give – what kind of – it quantifies the advantage that it gives the hitters versus the pitchers or the pitchers over the hitters, et cetera, et cetera. So the way this goes throughout the year, I really think that what he's doing could be revolutionary because he does what you do, which is more or less look and analyze back across at-bats. And how's this guy looking? And what are his hands low or his hands high? Did he change? And I know all of the little catch phrase lingo terms. They don't mean anything to me, so I only talk about them when I'm trying to sound important. But really and truly, there is things that you guys can translate into, you know, a little bit of a DFS edge that I can't. So I largely ignore it and let you guys just kind of start speaking up when there's something worth paying attention to. Cause I mean, I don't need to know everything. I just need to know who knows more than I do about a certain topic and listen to them about that. I mean, I don't know how to fix my car. I have a car mechanic for that. DFS is the same way.
Yeah.
I just need to know who the DFS guys are.
And I mean, we can take that and we can apply it towards pitchers. We can apply it towards, especially when we start getting into Coors Field slates, later in the week. I will be able to, cause I've watched games there since 1993. I've watched them pre-humidor. I've watched them post-humidor. I've watched, you know, I could go on and on and on about it, but like everybody and their dog was stacking against Kyle Freeland last year in Colorado. In fact, they've stacked against, you know, this is something that we'll talk about later on in the week, but at the DFS Army, we don't blindly stack Coors Field. We don't blindly stack, you know, either side of it. Like there are times where, yeah, they're going to be a core Coors Field, like Coors Field stacks are going to be cores. Like in all of our articles because of the quality of pitching that's going on there. But like if you've got a, you know, a Kyle Freeland versus another pitcher that has a very, very good, you know, repertoire to pitch in that ballpark, there's going to be times where I tell you to play the pitchers. You know, I'm not scared. Now it's a GPP mindset, but I ain't scared, you know, but there's going to be times where, like, the Dodgers open up this weekend in Coors Field, and the Dodgers have been one of the hottest hitting teams in baseball. I don't know who's going to be opening in Coors or anything like that, but I can promise you this. It's not a blind stack. Like, any of these guys aren't just blind stack, and we gain advantages that way. You know, we do it in Yankee Stadium. We do it in Oriole Park and Camden Yards. We do it in Globe Life. We do it all over MLB. We'll stat, like, we have, Seattle is one of the better hitters or pitchers parks, and both of us had stacks there last night. Ran out Dodger stacks the first three games of the season, mainly on opening day, and I crushed because I know that ballpark plays during the day compared to at night. You know,
see, that brings in something else too that people need to know, and that's weather. Weather impacts baseball more than any other sport. It's something you need to pay attention to. And I'm not talking about just rain chances. We all know that, you know, 60% chance of rain is scary for the pitchers and yada, 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 because, you know, they come out for two or three innings, and if they get pulled due to rain, then they're not coming back out. The starters aren't. The batters, you know, they'll go play cards for a little while, and they'll come back out, and they'll finish up their at-bats or whatever. But one little hidden nuance in there is cold weather, cold air, dense air. And that's something that we have Mark, the weather guy, for inside. He's got a great article about how weather influences baseball that people should go to our little MLB tab and look it up in the strategy section. I think it's free to read. And what you're going to find there is a little known fact that most people, that they see, oh my God, Coors Field, thin air, go stack the crap out. You might not want to do that in April. You know, I mean, the air up there is a little bit colder than usual. The ball doesn't really start jumping until some of the summertime stuff in earnest, when you really see their home run per nine start jumping at home. And that's largely why it's an atmosphere thing. It's a huge park, and so when the air is thicker and the ball has to fight more air to get out of it, kind of doesn't get out of it as frequently as it does when it's 80 degrees and, you know, and the ball's just flying right and left.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that
just we'll a little talk nuance about. That people don't know.
Yeah, and that's another thing that we'll talk about is, you know, the size of the park. For Coors Field is just it's the largest outfield in the major leagues. Like, the amount of,
it's like half the state of Colorado.
some feel like that. Some center fielders have said that, like, this is just the absolute, like, the wear and tear that your body takes in center field at Coors Field because of all the ground that you have to cover is absolutely astronomical. I was actually surprised that, you know, Charlie Blatt, and like, center fielder numbers in Colorado, if you look at like defensive metrics, which I think are all a bunch of hogwash anyways, you know, because it goes on player quality type, and a bunch of other metrics as well. But like, nobody will ever say that a Colorado Rockies center fielder is a good defensive player. You know, Dexter Fowler, his defensive metrics absolutely skyrocketed when he went to St. Louis or Chicago or Atlanta or Houston or wherever he was. Like, they went, he all of a sudden became a better defensive player. Well, no, that has nothing to do with it. You know, on paper, exactly. But, you know, it's not always the home run that's going to kill you in Denver. It's the bloop singles. And so that's why we have to be careful with not only the hitters, but the pitchers as well.
That's one thing you taught me a couple of years ago, just from talking in former podcasts and whatnot, is, okay, it's great for home runs. You know, that's on paper, that you can track that. But a lot of times what people break down when they look at park factors is also doubles and triples in these parks because of the big, big outfields. You know, maybe a ball hits a wall or maybe it hits a gap, because there's no doubt. I mean, I don't know. I hate to always talk in terms of analogies, but like, you know, if I hit a golf ball off the tee 240 yards and I'm off by, you know, half a degree, I'm still on the right side of the fairway. But if I hit it 350 yards and I'm off by half a degree, I'm in your swimming pool.
Yeah.
You know, the angle's the same as far as how offline it is, but the farther it travels, the more offline it gets. You know, sort of like building highways for engineers. If you start in Chicago and then start in New York and try to build a highway together, you better be absolutely perfect when you meet in Ohio somewhere, or you could be miles off just by being half a degree off, just like I'm trying to describe with the other. That leads to balls in gaps in baseball. It leads to balls in corners in baseball, which leads to doubles and triples, which also translates into park boosts, you know, in those big outfields. You know, San Diego is one. Coors is definitely one. Those bigger, more cavernous outfields are obviously harder to cover. Instead of a fourth guy out there, you only get three, the same three as you do everywhere else. And as a result, more balls hit the ground. And when they hit the ground, they're usually low and running. And so the guy chasing the ball has to be low and running himself, while the guy on the bases is low and running himself, and everybody's, you know, the shit's hitting the fan everywhere. And this guy's getting extra bases out of the deal, and that boosts the park factor. So.
Yep. And I mean, that's another thing, is like the outfield has to play so deep to cut off the gaps, you know, that a lot of bloops do fall in. So, but that's all stuff that we'll get into later on in the week. I'm sure that I'm going to have a lot of questions about Coors Field. I think they open Friday. It won't be, I don't think it's on the main slate. I think it's they usually do day games, on the first day of the, for their home openers. So I want to say it's at, it's before the main slate even happens. So I'm sure I'll get a lot of questions about that.
Sure.
But let's go on to kind of a process type building, thing. When I start my process, okay, the first thing that I'm going to do is I have a notebook that I write down every single matchup as far as
highlighter
pitchers.
Magic.
As far as, not quite yet. Highlighter magic didn't come out until the decisions were made. The process came out by me writing a bunch of stuff. I had to write things down in order to retain them. I still feel like I do half the time. I feel like my best days are usually when I do write them down when I have time. And after NBA regular season ends, that's when a lot of this will start to come out. But I write down all the pitching matchups. I want to know, obviously, who is pitching. And I used to basically the pitcher hub has kind of evolved, but the basis of it is basically the same as what I used to write down daily and look up on mm-hmm. FanGraphs. Okay. Now I've grown from FanGraphs to StatCast, but I still use FanGraphs for a lot of stuff as well. Get familiar with FanGraphs as a base to look up information. You can look up pretty much everything except for StatCast out of there. Okay. You can look up home road splits. You can look up how this guy fares the first time through the lineup, the second time, the third time, how many pitches he averages per start, how many innings is, you know, you can look up pretty much everything. How, you know, you can look up his pitch selection, what the velocity is, how often he throws it, you know, to XYZ batter, and you can do that per home, away, splits, all of it. Okay. Get familiar with learning how to decipher things pitching wise on FanGraphs. Okay. That's the first thing I would suggest you do. Just play around with it. Search, you know, Randy Johnson, search Marcus Stroman, search Jose Urena, Zach Greinke, whoever. And learn how to look at their pages on there. So you can, if you have a question about something, you can go there and look first before you start digging other places. But the part that I divulge into the most, I write down the Vegas lines. I want to know who the biggest favorite is, to start off, because then I can start looking into matchups and decide whether or not I think it's valid or not. And then kind of just go from there. Now, something you have to take into account with Vegas lines, and a lot of people don't realize and understand this. Yes, They are set per team. And yes, you know, as of quote unquote tonight, let's just take Marcus Stroman, for instance. He's a minus 185 favorite per Vegas. Okay. Now, the Toronto Blue Jays are not a good team, but obviously neither are the Baltimore Orioles. But this Vegas line is largely influenced by Marcus Stroman because of the quality of the pitcher he is. Okay. But, and that's why you see Vegas line shift from day to day based on who the starting pitcher is. I will say this. I caution everybody on this. Vegas early on, early in the season, is doing the same thing that we are. They are learning about these teams. They are learning who is good and who is not. They are learning how players have progressed or regressed. And they are making their best educated decision and educated guess. You can take advantage of this. Why do I, in tournaments anyways, why do I say this? Because if you look at Masahiro Tanaka or Chris Sale or Max Scherzer or Hyunjin Ryu or Blake Snell or Stroman, you can see heavy Vegas favorites, but they might not be the best matchup going up against the team that they're facing that night. You know, especially when lineups start to come out. Like, it's just, you can take advantage of this because of the numbers that we have. Now, Vegas has access to all these numbers as well. But in tournaments, heavy Vegas favorites are usually chalkier pitchers in cash games. And they usually garner a lot of ownership in tournaments as well. Am I wrong on this?
No.
For instance, yesterday, I don't remember what the actual line was, but Urias and Strom were the two chalkiest pitchers on the slate. I'm going to venture to guess that they were probably the two highest favorites on the slate as well.
I'm looking it up for you because I wrote it down. Okay. I write stuff down too. If I can find them here real quick. Well, I mean, I wrote, God, I went page on page on page on page yesterday. It was absolutely crazy because I'm trying to hone my process too, just like everybody else. Let's see, Tampa Bay, there was no line. What did that one come out? It came out.
Not Tampa. Gosh, I want to see. LA and San Diego.
Oh, you're, God, what was I thinking with Tampa Bay? San Diego was minus 165.
There you go.
And Dodgers were minus 210.
There you go.
I thought we, when were the, where were the 360s?
Those were
we had a couple of guys. Was that just 2 days ago, 3 days ago? We had a couple of 300s.
Masahiro Tanaka going up against the Baltimore Orioles was, it started at like a 370 and ended up making its way to a 410.
That thing was like a 410, 415.
Yeah, I think Chris Sale was minus a 335 against the Seattle Mariners on opening day and got absolutely shelled.
Sure he did.
You know, stuff like that. And so it's kind of...
You know,
which
that's worth mentioning. Like you were saying, people are kind of feeling themselves out. I don't know how many people listen to MLB Tonight on the MLB channel. I happened to last night as I was kind of, you know, winding down for the night. And I love listening to Pedro Martinez. That guy, he feels to me like coaches in the DFS Army. It feels like his life's mission is just to share everything he knows.
Who?
And I love guys like that. You know, where they just want to pass knowledge on. They just kind of want to give more than they take. And Pedro was talking about how when he was a starter and whatever else, it took him a little while to, you know, as a veteran, as he aged, it took him a little while to come out of spring training rolling, and took him two or three starts. And he feels the same way for Chris Sale. He feels the same way for Max Scherzer. He feels they're most vulnerable early in April for two reasons. One, they don't feel their secondary pitches quite as well.
Especially, you know, in the colder weather.
And then that was the second one, is when they go north and they go into those little bit colder environments, you lose a little bit of, you know, you may feel great in Florida, but then you don't feel so great in Minnesota or something. Well, Okay, so you put those two things together and you listen to what Pedro's telling you. And what Pedro's telling me as a DFS player is stack against the Aces early in April. Because they're great pitchers. They're not going to fail often. But they're going to fail more often in April. And that's when everybody's looking to get on a Chris Sale or get on a Max Scherzer. Oh, my God, he's back. It's time to really rock and roll. And then, boom, all of that ownership gets leveraged in some kind of a GPP stack. And I know I'm supposed to be the chalk eater cash guy, but I mean, some of this stuff, if you just allow yourself to think about what should happen and maybe how high the likelihood is that it might not happen as well, then you can take some very, very educated guesses and some educated shots on going a little bit against the grain. And I'm not saying I was there when Chris Sale gave up 8 runs. That didn't benefit me at all. Scherzer, same. These other guys, you know, I mean, getting shelled for Scherzer's giving up 3 runs, that's not necessarily going to win you a GPP with an opposing stack if you've got 4 guys and you only get 3 runs out of it. But at the same time, these are scenarios that if Pedro's telling you this is what happened, you know, in the, you know, the 90s and 2000s when he was doing it, and it's still going on today, these are things that you can pay attention to now. It might explain why Boston's offense is a little bit cold, why, you know, some of these other guys are having a little bit of trouble getting going. And that's, you know, you were always told you attack Greg Maddux early in the innings because that's when he's the most vulnerable. If you give him a chance to settle in, you're toast. That goes with all of the greats. And they time themselves, and you know this more than I even would, but they time themselves coming out of the bullpen warming up before a game to sort of spend that extra couple of pitches loosening up a little bit further because they're also knowing that they're wanting to save off the back end of their start in case they're still needed in the seventh inning and the eighth inning. And so they're planning themselves. They know their bodies.
Yeah, and you're 100% right on. You know,
they do that stuff on purpose. Yeah, and they do the same thing in spring training. They come out of spring training still not quite all the way there, kind of on purpose because they're planning for August.
August, September, October. And I typically like to fade pitchers that pitched deep in the playoffs the previous year and had a big workload in the previous season because they had a shorter offseason, not as much time. And you're thinking, oh, well, they still had 2-3 months to recover. Well, yeah, but when you're throwing at a high elite level like at MLB, you need all the time that you can possibly get.
And when you're 34 and 35 years old instead of 24 and 25.
Yep, exactly. But so to give you an example of, you know, saving it early on to wait for the later innings, there's a guy that's on tonight's slate. He's actually the second largest favorite, by the name of Justin Verlander, who absolutely does the exact same thing. You'll see him touching 93, 94 in the first inning. By the eighth inning, he's hitting 98, 99. He gets stronger as the game goes on. People have called me absolutely, completely loco when I've said I'm going to stack against Clayton Kershaw early in April. And guess what? I touch him up, you know? I mean, it doesn't mean that Clayton's not a great pitcher, but it does mean that there's certain times where you can attack him.
And you're not attacking Kershaw expecting him to blow up. There's a big difference there. You're not when we make these predictions as, you know, DFS guys, we're not anticipating tonight's going to be the night. We don't know. We just know that it's more likely to happen tonight than it is in 2 months. And right. We know that with everybody else afraid of Clayton Kershaw when he's at his peak, we can get greedy in that situation and we can leverage a ton of the field against itself if we get lucky and it does happen tonight. That's all we're banking on. But the thing is that when it happens, the payoff is so large. And your pathway to the top of these leaderboards is so much faster than having to fight through everybody else that's all huddled up around the chalky pitchers and whatever else that it doesn't have to happen that often. And that's one of the biggest things mentally that a daily fantasy player probably struggles with. They go on all this tilt and they say, it's not working for me. It's not working. Well, it depends on how you're playing. If you're playing pretty contrarian like that and you're stacking against the Clayton Kershaw, it doesn't have to happen, but maybe twice a year. And it can make your whole year if you're in the right tournaments and you're in the getting the right kind of a payday for it. So you have to save those types of bigger risk, you know, the chances that you're taking for things that are going to pay off. Now, don't stack against Clayton Kershaw on a 50-50 that's only going to pay you $2 on a dollar. You don't need to take that kind of risk
right.
in order to you know, get that kind of a reward. You would stack on against a Clayton Kershaw in a tournament that costs you a dollar, but the top prize is, say, $2,000. Oh, by all means, everything's on the table there. Because if you happen to get all the stars lined up for you that night, the payday is huge. So take that guy that is, you know, in a cold streak slump of 3 weeks long, and you just know he's going to break out of it, and maybe it's tonight, and that pitcher that hasn't been pitching very well, but maybe he puts it together tonight or whatever. That's what those gambles are for.
It's the only reason why I keep rostering Chris Davis.
Oh, well, there you go. But I mean,
because I know that he's going to be 5% owned, and I know he can go double dong.
The dude is double dong every night, and he leads.
He's also four strikeouts every night.
He can be. Do you know, this was another thing I picked up on MLB Tonight last night. Do you know that his first three seasons in 15, 16, and 17, or maybe it was 16, 17, 18, whatever his first three seasons were, he hit 247 each year.
No, wrong Chris Davis. Wrong Chris Davis.
Oh, you're thinking of Crush. Ha! Yeah. Okay. That's a little bit of a different story.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, now see where I would say that he's aging and regressing, and but here's the thing. The size of the contest matters. Would I play Chris Davis in a 50-50 or a head-to-head? No.
Oh, absolutely.
Would I play him in a 10-man league, a 20-man league, a 100-man league? Probably not. Why? Because on the dollar I invest in a 100-man league, first place is $25. That's probably still not quite enough of a payday for me to want to take that kind of a risk on a Chris Davis. However, the Baltimore Chris Davis. However, if I'm in a tournament that dollar pays me $1,000, then I want to be one of the very, very few guys in the world that has Chris Davis in my lineup the night he hits two home runs, because that is when I'm going to really leverage everything. And I don't care, because if you look at, and this is another thing that I've done in some of the videos on YouTube that I've done and whatever else, is I will compare contest selections or contest structures where we're looking for a few things. We want to see, first of all, how frequent we can win this contest by. How many people does it pay, and how much of the prize pool goes towards those slots? Where does that deep money start in those tournaments? Is it the top 10%? Is it the top 20%? Top 30%? You know, however, whatever. I'm just spouting off percentages, but the obviously the fewer people that it pays. Say you take a third of the prize pool. Say it's a $1,000 prize pool, and $300 goes to the top, say 1% or 2% of the player pool, then that's actually pretty good for the industry. But if it's only the top half of 1%, man, you really have to take some risk to get into that kind of money, to get that kind of reward. And you don't care if you finish in the top 2% of the world. Sure, you beat 98% of the people, but on your dollar, you get back $3. What do you care? That doesn't really help you build a bankroll. It doesn't really help you get a big payday for the risk that you took. You're trying to get way up into the top. And so that's why you need to take that risk in those types of tournaments. And that's stuff we talk about inside the Army all the time. And we're just starting to, I mean, or at least I'm just starting to kind of show a little bit of screen share stuff where I show you the math behind it and say, this is the kind of contest that you need to take the risk in. This is the kind of contest where you don't need to roster that. You don't need to roster Chris Davis in this contest. You'd save him for these. And so,
right.
People that like taking risk like you do, absolutely stay in some of those bigger contests. But as you get into some of those other contests that are a little bit smaller, a little bit easier to win, you know, some $30 tournament that only has 125 people in it, you don't need to take significant risk to win that tournament. That's why you see lower scores win those tournaments, because the pros know this. And so they're not taking they're tuning their level of risk to the amount of reward they're going to get for it. And that is a nuance that nobody in DFS talks about.
Yep.
And therefore, the recreational player doesn't know. So he's four stacking Toronto Blue Jays against me in cash last night. And I'm going, what is this guy doing? Toronto has done nothing all year. Excuse me. Toronto has done nothing all year. Several of the key players in those stacks have not done anything yet. fine. You want to put that in a tournament with a high reward on the dollars you invest? Man, be my guest. That's where that belongs. Don't put it in a 50-50 or a head-to-head against me. It's not needed there. In fact, it's actually suboptimal to put it there for the contest type. You're going to get lucky. They got lucky against me last night, whipped my ass. And that's fine, because I know that over the course of 6 months, I'm going to win all of that money back off of you if that's how you play cash games. Because first of all, four stacking is not something you need to be doing very often in those types of situations. And second of all, colder offenses that are underperforming, that you're just banking on getting hot someday, that's just not a recipe for success in a contest where you just don't need a lot to go right to win it. You save that for the contest where you need everything to go right to win it. And now you're at least catering your lineup and your constructions of your lineups towards the appropriate contests. And that is probably one of the biggest leaks that the DFS player has in his game that he can quickly, very quickly fix if he just studies how contests are structured just a little bit.
Yep. And I would agree with that. Okay. So the next thing after, you know, I get all that down is I want to start looking at their splits. I want to know how they do versus right, how they do versus left. I want to know, you know, K percentage, walk percentage, all that stuff doesn't matter. I want to know basically what the K percentage of the lineup is. And I find that in the lineups page. You know, and it's one of those things like it alternates as, or it adjusts as the lineups come out. So like I can see that if say the Orioles have a 24% projected K percentage, and then they put a couple guys in there that don't strike out a lot, then, you know, my opinion could change based on the lineup that comes out. You know, I want to know if they allow more power to the right or the left side of the plate. I want to know, you know, I want to know the splits of these guys. So I'll go through and I'll look at that and I'll write basically sort per, it's a pitcher or, you know, I want to know, do they get hit harder on the right or on the left side of the plate? So I know how to kind of attack it, or to lay off. It's something that we do as coaches every single day. And it's something that we base our decisions off of. Now, when we start getting more numbers for this season, they'll work out a lot better. But until then, you know, we've got to do this and we've got to go by the history of the players. You know, I'm not going to attack Chris Sale with a bunch of lefties unless that lefty knows how to hit left-handed pitching. I'm not going to attack Justin Verlander with I'm not going to attack him a lot at all, you know, unless he's going through one of those little, you know, stretches. You know, I don't, there's just certain. And you start to learn this as the season goes on. I want to kind of add this in. You don't have to have a process defined April 2nd.
Correct.
Like, the season's going to go through September. You don't have to have a process defined right now. But
you might want to play lightly until you do.
But you, exactly. Unless you've been doing this a while, then, and even then, you know, you could possibly lay off a little bit, but unless you've been doing this a while and you kind of know what to look for and how you handle the beginning part of the season, then make sure that you account for the fact that you're still developing a process, that you're learning the different tools, that you're learning how to work the lineup station or the lineup page. You're learning how to work the domination station or learning how to work the research station. And knowing what to look for in all of these aspects.
And temper your emotions on the results, both high and low. Because if you don't have a process yet, or we're only 5 days into the season yet, you don't know if you're getting lucky or not yet. You could be getting lucky. You could be getting unlucky. You could be right on the freaking bullseye. I don't know. You don't know yet. We don't have enough of a sample yet to tell you. However, if you keep using the same process, that whatever you're using right now, and slowly start adding to it, you can very quickly start to tell if you've added something that worked or didn't work, or maybe because I've added elements to my process and, oh man, just had a bad night. Well, that doesn't mean change it all tomorrow. That means play it again, reevaluate, play it again, reevaluate. After about a week, if things have not gone well, then I can say, huh, adding that probably didn't help. So then I can take it out and then play it for a week and then see, did my results actually recover? And if they did, then okay, that's a bad metric. That's something that I shouldn't be prioritizing. And the exact opposite works for when you add something and it really, really works. That doesn't mean, oh my God, all of a sudden now instead of playing $5 a night, I'm going to play like $500 a night. Don't do that. Wait a day or two or three or four and see if your results continue to keep, you know, even one thing you can do to monitor your process is you can look at 50-50s and you can look at head-to-heads. And this is an area where I would say if you want to put GPP lineups in them, man, freaking go for it. I don't care. Because if you're monitoring your results and you're trying to test a process, a 50-50 is a great contest to get into. Why? Because you get 100 lineups to measure up against you for like a dollar. So I don't care about my results in those things when I'm testing things out. I only care about where am I finishing. Am I finishing in the top 80, the top 70, the top 30, the top 20? How often am I hitting the top 20? Because that's the GPP number. How often am I hitting the top 20? How often am I getting into the top 5? Am I winning this thing? And I'm going to track over, say, a week, 2 weeks. How often did I do that? Did I do it 8 times out of 14? If so, I'm on to something. Did I only do it 3 times? Well, then was it luck or am I not onto something? These are the types of things. Head-to-heads, very, very similar. But you're going to get, in my opinion, a better comparison or a better snapshot. Or if you want to throw it in a quarter and throw it in the quarter arcade, and if you get totally lucky and win the thing, by all means. But what I'm doing when I'm experimenting is I'm tracking where my lineup falls and how often it falls in those categories of, you know, percentage of the overall finishers. I want them in the top 50%. Like as often as I can possibly get them there. And I want them in the top 20% quite a bit and the top 1%. Those are the numbers that I look for because the top 50% wins cash games. The top 20% min cashes GPPs and the top 1% wins 100-man leagues. And if I've got upside beyond that and I can get, I personally, my process over 2-3 years worth of working on it doesn't get past the top 1% too terribly often. But if it does, it starts getting into the deep money of the GPPs pretty quickly. And so those are just, like I said, those are the three numbers I look for, top 50%, top 20%, top 1%. How often am I hitting those barriers? And that's what I gauge my process on. The results is, you know, I'll look over a week, I'll look over 2 weeks and see how often did I do that? How often did I get there? And then do I need to add something or change something to my process? That's when I go to coaches.
Yep.
You know, and say, hey, Keith, or hey, whoever, hey, whatever, I'm looking at the, am I over prioritizing this? And then they can usually tell me based on their own process and where they kind of feel about, yeah, I don't really look at, last 7 days WOBA. I look more at X WOBA, or I look more at these other statistics that we have inside our research stations. And they can, I don't look at really 7 day samples. I look at 14 day samples. Or then I can start taking that and go, okay, well, this guy, I've seen him. He shares some of his results. I've seen his results be pretty good. Now, maybe he's doing something differently than I am that benefits me. I might want to take my process from the last 7 days, shift it to a little bigger sample of last 14 days. and then track it for another couple of weeks and see if my results change. These are the kinds of things that recreational players don't do because they don't know to do, because they don't have a place where they can go and talk about it and get advice from people that have been there and done that. And that's what we do.
And one of the big things I want to piggyback on that, then we'll go on to the hitter side of things, is, you know, it's we have the coaches that are available for you. My schedule will get a little bit lighter once NBA regular season stops, but I'm not the only one. Any of these coaches can help you. And make sure that you – how to say this? Make sure you find a coach that fits your style of play. Because mine won't fit the cash game heavy type of player.
No, I could not follow Keith religiously and succeed with the contests I like to play. And he couldn't me.
Right.
Doesn't work. But so, I know when to ask Keith questions, and he knows when to ask me questions, like we've been talking about, you know, this whole podcast. And every other coach is that way too. If you get to know them, you ask some questions, you converse with them. Don't expect to come in on day one and say, hey, who should I trust? That doesn't work, man. You're going to have to sit down and talk to some of these guys, build a little bit of a relationship or some rapport with them, get to know how they play by listening to how they advise other people, and then determine, is this the kind of guy I should be listening to, or is he maybe playing a game a different way than I am?
Right. Exactly. So, all right. So let's go on to the hitters. Okay.
Ooh, one more thing before you transition completely into hitters, I want to tell people my process is very simple. The first thing I start with during the day is I find the pitchers, the good pitchers, the guys with high strikeout upside that go deep into games that should be in line for a win. And then the next thing that I do is I flip it on its head and I find the bad pitchers. Why? Because the bad pitchers are what is going to transition me into finding hitters, and the good, you know, teams, the good offenses, the good stacks, if you will, to target the bad pitchers. So that transitions into what Keith is getting ready to talk about now, which is how he finds hitters. Go.
Right. That kind of goes in there. You know, you find when you're finding good pitchers, you'll find good hitter or you'll find bad pitchers as well. And you can kind of piggyback on that. Now, I always look at splits. They're not the end all be all. Like, I want to know if a guy has the ability to hit left-handed pitching, if he's left on left, or if he's right on right. There, I feel the use of I'm not gonna take lefty versus lefty is too overblown. Because there are some hitters that can hit left-handed pitching. There are some left-handed hitters that can hit left-handed pitching. I'm not going to just take a guy based on the handedness advantage. I'm not going to fade a guy based on the handedness, quote unquote, disadvantage. You know, but I want to know if a guy has a 117 wOBA versus left-handed pitching and he's in the starting lineup, but I look at the bullpen and realize that they don't have any left-handed arms in the pen that are probably going to be available, and the guy's like a fourth or fifth starter where you know, he's only going to see him, you know, maybe two times. I'll take a shot in a GPP if he's only going to face righties coming out of the pen and he crushes right-handed pitching.
Because, you know, everybody's going to see the left on left and they're going to freak out and they're going to fade the guy.
Yep. You know, I'll attack bullpens. You know, if we've got a guy that, you know, is going to be limited to, you know, six innings or so, because that seems about the average that he usually goes through, especially early in the season. I'll attack bullpens.
And here's the thing for the more recreational, less experienced player. Don't listen to what Keith is saying and then suddenly say, okay, so I'm not afraid of lefty versus lefty anymore. That's not what Keith is telling you.
No.
What Keith is saying is don't, you know, default in avoiding the left versus left, just like the herd, the sheep, the crowd does. Because why? Because it's logical. Because they're probably a little too lazy to dig into all of the research. I'm in one of those lazy crowds. They're not going to dig in to the bullpens and then think, oh, is this guy going to not make it to the sixth or seventh inning and they don't have any lefties available? That's where that leverage at a GPP gets you up into that top 1% and deep into the money when it works out for you. Don't listen to what Keith is saying and say, okay, I'm never going to worry about left versus left again. I'm just going to roster him. Because what Keith is telling you is don't go rostering those guys unless you've dug in and done the work.
I'll give you an example. Find them. And it's because he's close to home. Now, I'm not saying that this guy is good to use tonight. That's not what I'm saying. I have not dug into the slate. Let's be clear about that. But this is an example. The Tampa Bay Rays are throwing Blake Snell tonight. He is a left-handed pitcher. Okay.
Here comes Charlie Blackmon.
Yep. Charlie Blackmon last season had a 337 ex-WOBA and a 354 WOBA versus left-handed pitching with only a 19.9% K rate.
Better than a lot of right-handed batters.
Very true. Okay. Now, does that mean that I'm going to automatically blindly roster Charlie Blackmon tonight? No, that does not mean that at all. I have not looked into the slate. I want to make that very clear. But
it means you're going to dig into him.
But that does mean I'm going to dig into it. Okay. That does mean that against certain lefties, I know Charlie can hit left-handed pitching. Like, I know he can. But there are other people out there like that. Like, I'm trying to find another one here. So Brandon Crawford used to be one of those guys. He had a bad year against lefties last year. Cole Calhoun had a really good year against lefties last year.
Yes, he's on my list tonight because of that, and it's early in the year this year.
You know, and it's just one of those things. There aren't too many left-handed pitchers tonight, so I don't have a lot of examples to kind of go by. But you know, I'm not gonna just avoid left versus left just because.
You know, one I'd look into. You know, one I'd look into, and this is just me telling you. Because I know there's only four people listening. I'd look at a Jared Dyson.
He's got to crack the lineup first.
he's got some plate appearances. He's been hitting the ball when he's been in the lineup. And if he does, I think he's left versus left. And it would be really intriguing for me because it's not the worst matchup in the world in the game tonight to maybe look into him, because I think Arizona as an overall team is in a pretty good spot facing – you know, a vulnerable pitcher, if you will. Therefore, I find it interesting that two or three of the bats in Arizona are left on left. When a vulnerable pitcher comes into that left on left situation, I want to look at those lefties and see if they can hit left-handed pitching, because if they can, then maybe that matchup is actually a good one. And if they can't, then maybe that matchup is completely overblown by Vegas or some of the other number metrics that we looked at that say it's a good matchup, because sometimes those are traps.
Yep, exactly. I'm going to touch on one thing and one thing here very, very quickly, mainly because it's a discussion that we could have a whole podcast about and we need to kind of wrap it up. Okay. we do advise you breaking down the numbers for the splits for all the hitters and stuff, and the lineups pay does a fantastic job on that. We're not going to go too much into building on stacking or anything like that because we don't have time, because when me and Chop get together on podcasts, we talk a lot. Yep. However, I want to touch on BVP. Okay. And this is going to be literally, Chop, we need to make this like 2 minutes, very, very That's short. Fine. If a guy is 2-for-4 with a home run, it does not hold the same weight as if a guy is 15-for-59 with 4 home runs, or 19-for-39 with 5 doubles and 4 home runs. Okay? And yes, I did just give 2 BVP numbers for 2 players tonight. Okay?
I got a 19 out of 39 with 4 home runs.
Yeah, I just said that.
I thought you said like 15 for 59 or something.
I said,
but anyway.
I said both.
We're looking at the same dude.
Yeah, we're looking at the same two dudes. Because those two... Now, if a guy is like 6 for 8 with 2 home runs, then I have interest.
Sure.
I know personally that BVP is real. Okay? Because there are some times where you just pick the ball up out of the hand better based on the way you stand at the plate, based on this, based on that. And guess what? You start to have success. Pitchers know that. They understand that. They realize that. Okay? This is a numbers game, but it is still played by human beings. And BVP, I don't care what people tell you, BVP does play a part into it, and it is real. I know I just lost about 500 people.
The question is, when does it become real? That's the only question. It's not whether or not it is real. Anybody telling you that it's not real is full of crap.
Oh, there are plenty of touts out there in the DFS world that would say that if you're applying BVP to your DFS decisions, that you basically have no idea what you're talking about.
I know, and those guys are morons, and you shouldn't be listening to them, and you shouldn't be paying for their websites, because they've just disqualified themselves right off by saying something so close-minded.
I personally believe that if you think that BVP isn't real, you've never played a lick of competitive baseball at a higher level. Or at least had any sort of success. Yeah, but I'm not saying you can't believe in it and not play. Right. I'm saying if you don't believe in it, you haven't.
I mean, it doesn't take much logic to sit and look at a television screen and watch a guy coming way over the top or coming three quarters or coming submarine style with a sidearm pitch to realize that that's going to change the way that a hitter sees the ball coming out of his release point. Some of them come from behind their ear. Some of them come from out behind their shoulder a little bit more. That's all pretty logical to anybody who's watched baseball for any significant amount of time. And some hitters are going to see that better. And if I can see the ball come out of your hand better, or if I know that you'll come from here with a fastball or maybe here with a curveball or something, that's giving me an advantage. And if I'm the type of player that has the talent to capitalize on that advantage, it's going to translate into how much I own your butt.
Yep. Now, it doesn't always work, but nothing in baseball will always work.
It's a round ball or round bat, dude.
Yeah, it's the hardest. Hitting a baseball is the hardest single thing to do in professional sports.
I'd argue sinking a 4-foot putt with a million on the line, but okay.
Okay, but
I digress, dude. Go ahead. I'm just joking.
So, yes, I am a believer, and I'm sorry if I insulted any of my fellow colleagues by saying that.
It's just a matter, again, of when you believe. Do you believe it at 5 at-bats, 10 at-bats, 20 at-bats, 50? When do you believe it? And I'm with
you. It's a case-by-case situation.
Correct.
So
even that depends. Because you could be 3 for 5 with 3 bombs off of a guy, and by God, I'm going to be paying attention.
Yep. Now, I also –
I'll never argue it's not. But
here's the thing. If you're 19 for 39 against somebody, but you don't have any extra base hits, then I'm paying attention as well. So it goes. Sure. It depends what the BVP is, and it goes.
But I'm not going to say you don't own that pitcher, because that pitcher clearly can't get you out. What I'm going to say is that you might not have the upside to win me a GPP unless you're dirt cheap. You might have is you might be in one of those rare instances where I don't worry that much about lower ownership in a cash game.
Yep.
Because he isn't going to get you out.
Right.
You might end up with a hit or two off of him, get me 6 points on FanDuel or something, and do it for $2,400. And I'm happy as a lark with a situation like that in a cash game, because it allows me to go spend $4,000 on somebody else.
Yep. So – alrighty, Chop. First strategy pod of the season. Kind of went pretty well. So hopefully we will be doing some more of these on a more consistent basis, and we're looking to try to kind of actually get this going on Twitch. We did it on short notice today, so that's why we didn't do that. So
And I can't get up and pace around my kitchen and stuff if I'm on Twitch anyway. I have to sit still.
There you go. So all right, for myself, for Chop, for the DFS Army, we gone.